If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Atlantic Coast Mortgage, Equal Housing Lender, NMLS 643-114.
Facebook, Google, all of these companies are trying to figure out where are the rules and where are they going to draw the line.
There's clearly a demand for renters. They've got most of them full.
If you own a bond in your retirement portfolio, the price of that is going to go down.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
Welcome, everyone, to Thursday afternoon. Steve Bertrand here in the Allstate Skyline Studio as we get things going on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Ian Scher will be here in just a minute or so. In the second half hour, we're going to talk to a reporter from USA Today, Steve Berkowitz, writing about the NCAA case. It's in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals right now out west, an argument over whether or not or how much NCAA athletes should be paid. So something that might be coming or might not. We'll talk to Steve Berkowitz about that in the second half hour. We start things off on Thursdays with Any Luck at All with Ian Scher, a senior editor at CNET.com. Ian, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks. Let's start with Facebook and what the Trump administration is doing now. It looks like it was last night, but it's making news today that the Trump administration is... Are they suing Facebook? Are they're taking them to court, or they're charging them? Or I'm not sure exactly what's going on here.
Yeah, so they are suing Facebook for discrimination in advertising, and this is a result of a couple of ProPublica articles that came out over the last couple of years that showed that people could set up advertisements on Facebook and decide whether or not, you know, people by location, by race, by all sorts of stuff. And they said that this was being used to discriminate in housing ads. Of course, that's illegal. And so what happened was that there was a lawsuit with the ACLU. Facebook settled it. Now the Department of Housing and Urban Development is basically seeking damages for anyone who was harmed by this advertising practice, even though now Facebook says they fixed it.
So how do you prove that you've been harmed?
Well, that's going to be the tough part, right? I mean, I think that this is the issue that happens with a lot of these types of lawsuits. Is that you end up trying to kind of prove that everyone, you know, a certain number of people were hurt possibly by, you know, by being someone who was trying to rent in a certain area and then showing that there were ads that were being shown that were not being shown to them. But it's going to be really tough. And I think at the end of the day, what this turns into is the government trying to kind of beat Facebook over the head for having done this in the first place.
It's kind of a weird story because it's a case of Facebook getting in trouble for its sweet spot, right? I mean, this is why advertising on Facebook is attractive to advertisers because they can very clearly design where their ads are seen. That's a selling point, but they have to be careful when it comes to housing and other things like that.
Yeah, exactly. And that, you know, the odd part is that a lot of times when we talk about where Facebook is broken or having a lot of struggles, it's always in all the other stuff that's not advertising. They tend to really be smart about this stuff, and they have some of the smartest people working on advertising stuff. But here's an example where they really just weren't thinking.
You pulled an article from CNET about the EU moving toward tightening copyright laws or what can be posted or how copyrighted stories or content can be posted online. And I'm interested in it because it seems like it could be a dramatic shift. And I don't know. Is it a sign of what might be coming here one day?
It absolutely could be a sign. I mean, there's a lot of talk about how we all have learned over the last couple of years exactly how unprepared and unknowledgeable the Senate and the Congress are here in the United States. So seeing the European Union do even more, you know, they already have a law called GDPR, the General Data Protection Rule, which they have, which basically requires that companies be very upfront with how they use our data, ask for permission before they share or sell it. I mean, wacky ideas, right? It would be nice if we had even a hint of that here.
Right, right.
So there's a lot of assumption that eventually the U.S. is going to copy GDPR for the United States, which is why a law like this is very interesting. What's going on with this copyright directive that is winding its way through European Parliament is that it has two specific things that are worrying Silicon Valley. One is that it would basically make the people who run websites that upload copyrighted material, so let's say I upload South Park to YouTube, they'd be automatically in trouble versus having to take it down, and if they don't take it down, they're in trouble. And then the other thing is called a link text. And that link text would be, you know, you go to Google News and you see a little snippet of the news there.
Right.
Well, they would be taxed for that. And they say, well, if that's going to be the case, we're not going to run Google News anymore.
So tell me,
it's really fascinating how this is playing out.
Okay, so we're going to go more slowly here. So I'm a user of YouTube, and if I post a copyrighted version of, I think you said South Park, then I'm
right.
then YouTube is in trouble right away for allowing that copyrighted material to be posted by me?
Yeah, essentially the assumption of the law, and again, it's still in its being built phase, right? It's not a full law yet, is that these companies need to be better at stopping copyrighted material from being uploaded and instead of waiting for you and me to flag it to them. And, you know, part of the reason is because there is technology today that can identify, for example, child pornography as it's uploaded to the internet and stop it. So you would think that they could do that with copyrighted material, too.
And then, so the other part is then if I run my own, you know, Steve's news website, and I post links to New York Times stories or Chicago Tribune stories or WGN radio stories, that you would come to see those aggregated and then click on those, that I would be taxed for doing that because I'm using copyrighted material to sell my webpage?
Essentially, but, you know, the big thing here right now is that it would be a snippet, right? So it wouldn't be just a link. It would be a link and then, like, the first paragraph.
Oh, some actual material. And, right.
Right, which is how Google News works, right? It always gives you a little snippet along with. So it's going to be interesting to see, you know, there's a lot of concern that the EU might overreach. But, you know, you have to think their European governments feel that they need to beat Silicon Valley over the head, especially because the United States is not doing it. So. Okay. It's going to be interesting to see how this plays out.
Okay, 30 seconds. Apple made its big unveil or reveal, or you choose the verb, earlier this week. What's your takeaway from it?
I think it's fascinating. I mean, basically, Apple has been selling us high-priced electronics for years, and now they say they're going to focus more on creating content, video, TV, movies, news, all sorts of stuff. And it's a really interesting time, and you're talking about a time where I'm already paying for Netflix, Hulu, Amazon Prime, Disney in the future, all these things.
Right.
Apple wants to be another one. It's going to be a tough sell, but it's interesting.
I'm going to need a new credit card to keep up with all of it.
That too, right? The Apple credit card, exactly.
Ian Schur, read more at CNET.com. Great to talk to you, Ian. I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank. Bill Geiger is in the studio. Our regular conversations with Bill are sponsored by Geiger Wealth Management. Bill, welcome back.
Nice to be here, sir.
All right. So, well, we talk retirement when the two of us get together.
Yes.
And what's the most important thing that listeners getting ready for retirement should be focusing on now? Like where, you know, the villa in Florida, maybe the Swiss Alps?
That's kind of the benefit.
Yeah. Oh, that's you got to do the work first.
Well, a lot of times people are already doing the work. They've been saving like crazy. But what they don't have is really a plan. You know, they've been focusing on making the stack of money as tall as possible, but they don't know how much money they'll really need to retire, how much income they need, whether the money's going to last.
And right.
They haven't really sat down and put a plan together.
How do you come up with the dollar figure? Because everyone says you got to figure out how much you need to retire or how much you need to live on. And, you know, that still baffles me, like what my monthly income level should be.
Well, let me give an example. We had a couple come in. Wife is 59, husband 61. They have $1.5 million saved in their portfolio. You would think maybe that's enough, right? But they didn't. I mean, they were so uncomfortable. The guy said to me, he says, Bill, he says, I don't know if I'm doing everything I should be doing, everything I could be doing. The wife says, I don't know how much money I'm going to be able to spend in retirement,
right,
whether our money's going to last us. So we put them through a three-meeting process, Steve. And the first meeting, we get to know who they are, what's important to them. The second meeting, we look at their portfolio, tell them the good, the bad, the ugly of it. In a third meeting, we make recommendations to get them to the point where they know that their money will last,
right,
how much income they can retire on, what kind of lifestyle they get, and also when they can retire. That's a big question people come in with.
Well, and I think you also know ideas that I wouldn't know. Like, you know, you have to spend more in healthcare when you're older, right?
Yes,
and those are expenses that I might not be thinking about right now, but experts would be aware of.
And the husband said this to me at the end of our first meeting. He says, "Bill, I'm not sure I know the right questions to ask."
Right.
And I think that's what you're saying there.
So how do you do that? What are the steps that people take in order to get to where they need to be?
Well, we need to understand what their current lifestyle costs them right now. And we use that as like a starting point. You know, if your lifestyle costs you $8,000 a month, it's not going down because you retire. So we start with that, and we look at saying, what's your income sources? Social Security, pension. What are we missing? How do we create that missing amount of income so you have enough coming in each month, you can pay your bills and enjoy your life?
Yeah, I think that's one of the things we think about. Is like, well, I can live on 65% of what I'm, you know,
nope.
making now.
No,
75.
No, you save on dry cleaning by not working.
Oh yeah,
yeah, but you
save on commuting.
You still eat. You still go to movies, and you're probably going to travel more.
Golf more. Right.
Play with the grandkids more. Go more trips and stuff. It ends up you take a bump up when you retire.
So tell me the difference between someone when they come in and plan and then after they've got to plan.
You can kind of see it in their expressions. When they come in, they're a little bit nervous. You know, how's this going to work out? Do we have enough? Is it going to last? And when they leave and they have some assurance on all those things, like their shoulders are a little bit lower.
Right.
You know? They're more relaxed. They're happy. I told you this story about the couple that left our office and kissed outside.
Yeah, I love that story.
The glass store.
You should put a little kissing booth up outside your store, I think.
And a little photo booth.
Right,
huh?
Yeah, right, right.
Yeah. So they feel a whole lot better.
Yeah.
It's relaxing.
Okay, so just give, you know, a nutshell of advice of people who right now maybe are 55 or 60 years old,
yeah.
You know, and they're listening and they know they should be doing something. What's the first thing they should be doing?
Well, two things in general, Steve. One is to sit down with someone who specializes in retirement planning, just not somebody that has been managing their portfolio necessarily, because it's different when mm-hmm. you get close to retirement. And make sure there's a process. Make sure you're going to walk away with the right kind of answers.
You don't get a do-over, really.
No, you don't. When you retire, if you end up running out of money, nobody sets the reset button.
Right.
Steve, what we're talking here about is putting together a plan for your retirement. Folks, if you're listening, you're late 50s, early 60s, and this is ringing some bells with you, the next five callers who call in who have at least $500,000 saved up for retirement, we're going to sit down with you on a complimentary basis and do exactly what we've been talking about today.
All right, Bill Geiger, thanks for coming by. Go enjoy some baseball. It's opening day.
My pleasure, sir.
Thanks very much, Eric Rung. Steve Bertrand here on the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN. All right, the Sweet 16 gets underway for the NCAA basketball tournament tonight. And will the players next year, the year after, be being paid to play above board this time? Well, there's a court case making its way through the federal court system out west, I believe it is. And Steve Berkowitz, who covers such things for USA Today, is following it. He joins us now to give us a little update. Steve, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
All right, so tell me, this is, right, it's the Ninth Circuit, so that's the circuit out west, correct?
Yes.
All right, so it starts with a local circuit court judge, and she is ruling, there's the plaintiffs in the case say that athletes should be entitled to some compensation. The NCAA and conferences are on the other side of that, and the NCAA and the conferences, it's an odd thing, right? They won at the circuit court level?
Well, it sort of depends on your point of view
yeah,
on this. Technically speaking, the plaintiffs won, and what the plaintiffs are seeking is an end to association level rules that limit what athletes can receive for playing sports. They proposed a system under which any limits that would be in place would be put in place by the conferences, as long as the conferences didn't collude among each other. The idea being that you would have greater competition for the services of athletes based on what conferences or their member schools would be willing to offer them.
So the NCAA could not pay, but the Big Ten could.
Correct. The schools would be allowed to offer. They wouldn't be forced to offer. They would just simply be allowed if they so chose. However, that's not what the judge gave the plaintiffs. The judge found there was an antitrust violation, so in that sense, the NCAA lost. However, the judge did not grant the plaintiffs what they wanted, which was an unfettered marketplace within the conferences. She said that what would be allowed, however, is that there would not be limits placed on education-related benefits that the athletes would be able to receive. So, for instance, schools would be able to offer athletes the prospect of having their graduate school paid for at another institution, which is not the case currently. What she is not allowing, however, is the situation where athletes, for instance, would be able to, if the marketplace bared it, to allow them to get consideration for signing autographs or able to have a deal with a local car dealership or any of those kinds of things that whatever else the schools might otherwise offer that don't have anything to do with education.
So they couldn't offer like a graduation bonus. You know, you graduate, we're going to give you $5,000. That's not part of the...
No, actually, that is part of it. That would be considered a benefit related to education, and she was indexing the amounts of money that would potentially be available for academic achievement bonuses against the value of items that athletes can receive for participating in bowl games and things like that. So there's a whole set of NCAA rules that say athletes can receive those kinds of gifts and items of that nature, but they have to be within certain dollar limits. And so what the judge is saying is that the schools would be able to offer cash payments for academic achievement, and the amounts that would be available would be indexed against the total value of the sort of prizes that athletes are allowed to get under the rules, and that's a very gray area of what that value actually adds up to.
Well, and then the NCAA filed an appeal. They did it in the dark of night last Friday as the NCAA tournament was underway, and as you point out in your story, as the Mueller report was being released, that's what the plaintiffs argue anyway. It's before the circuit now, the Ninth Circuit. What comes next, and what do you see coming out of this?
Well, what will happen now is there'll be a series of written legal filings that are going to be happening over the summertime. Yesterday, the Ninth Circuit set the briefing schedule for this, so the NCAA has to make a filing by July 3rd, and the plaintiffs have to file an answer by early August, and then there would be another filing by the NCAA in late August. So that's just the written filings, and then the court would decide whether or not they want to have oral argument, and so, you know, you'd see how it goes. So you're talking about it probably at least a year to a year and a half get a ruling.
So no matter what, Alabama's football players aren't going to be being paid above board next year.
Correct. I think everything would be on hold. The status quo would remain pending the outcome of the appeal.
What's your prediction? I mean, what do you think will happen?
This is really hard to say, and it may depend on which judges in the Ninth Circuit take or assign to the case. Claudia Wilkin, who's the district judge in California who issued this ruling, also was the judge involved in a prior antitrust case that was filed on behalf of a guy named Ed O'Bannon, a former UCLA basketball player. And Judge Wilkin was deliberately assigned this latest case, and that was by design. I don't know whether the Ninth Circuit will use the same three judges who weighed in on the NCAA's appeal of O'Bannon, or whether or not you would get three different judges. And so with that, it's very difficult to sort of assess at this point how this might turn out.
Steve Berkowitz will be writing about it at USA Today. We'll continue to follow it. Steve, thanks for joining us today.
Sure, thanks for having me on.
You bet. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
Here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. You know trends have gone big when big box retailers jump in on the fun. And here you go. Walgreens, in addition to select CVS stores, has started offering products with CBD in them in 1,500 stores across the country. Now, I just want to reiterate, these are not products that contain weed and will not get you high if you use them. It's a compound of the plant, commonly in oil form, that has been shown to help with anxiety, cognition, movement disorders, and pain. Walgreens said this product offering is in line with our effort to provide a wider range of accessible
accessible health and well-being products and services to best meet the needs and preferences of our customers. Listening to what the market is telling you is important and something that should be learned from. So then this would be a perfect event. Next week, on April 2nd and 3rd, the Chicagoland Chamber of Commerce is checking in on the state of the mid-market. The National Center for the Middle Market will be leading the Chicagoland Chamber of Commerce event. Makes sense. And you can check out the details on chicagolandchamber.org. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Thanks very much, Orion Samuelson. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank. All right, how about it? A good idea for your kids to have their own credit cards, or a bad idea? I don't know that there's one answer. Ted Rossman is an industry analyst at creditcards.com, and they've been looking at this. Ted, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Good afternoon, Steve.
I'm interested in the numbers. So 8% of U.S. parents with children under 18 say at least one of their kids has a credit card. Neither of my kids had a credit card under 18. I'm kind of surprised by that number.
Yeah, I like it for a couple reasons. One is building credit. FICO's found that 1 in 5 U.S. adults don't have enough of a credit history to even generate a FICO score. So I think starting early can be a good thing. And I also like it from a money management lifestyle kind of idea. I think it's important to teach kids about plastic and not just bills and coins. So much of finance these days is either on plastic or increasingly on phones. I think we need to teach kids about that.
How hard is it or easy is it to get a credit card? Because I'll tell you, when my daughter turned 18 or went off to college, maybe she was 19, you know, we wanted, for those reasons, her to have her own credit card to build up her credit. And I got help from my friends at Wintrust because we had a hard time getting her a credit card because she had no credit history.
It is very difficult to get a credit card before age 21. You can sometimes do it at 18 if you can prove income or, you know, some other relationship with the bank. But in general, when we're talking about kids having credit cards, it's an authorized user relationship. They're getting added to their parents' account.
Well, that could be tricky then, couldn't it? I mean, then the parents could suffer if the kids go crazy in their spending.
It's definitely important to stay on top of your spending. American Express, for example, lets the primary account holder set limits on authorized user spending. So that's one idea. Or if this whole credit card thing really scares you, you could opt for a prepaid debit card. That's still a great way to teach your kids about money. And there's a growing class of these targeted at teens and young adults. Some examples include Greenlight, GoHenry, and Current.
Well, isn't that then kind of just a debit card by a different name?
It is, but what I like about the three I just mentioned is that they have a lot of guidelines and training wheels, so parents can set spending limits, they can say which stores are approved or disapproved, there's a lot of budgeting tools and instant alerts. I like, though, that this gives the kids some independence, and it gets them used to plastic, because it really is different. There's not as much friction or pain with paying with a card. So I think we need to teach kids safely that it's not magic money, that you need to pay it back, and just get them used to that rather than just bills and coins.
And I said earlier that 8% of parents across the country have a child under 18 with a credit card. And I don't know what to make of this, but I'm going to ask you about it anyway, because broken down geographically, they're much more likely, those parents, to live in the Northeast than elsewhere. 13% of children with credit cards live in the Northeast, 8% live in the South and West, 5% in the Midwest. Why is it that we in the Midwest are least likely to give our kids credit cards?
I thought that was interesting also. One hypothesis, and I know it's a stereotype, is maybe Midwesterners are a little bit more traditional. Or on the other side, with the Northeast being number one, I wonder if that has to do with a lot of Northeasterners working in the financial industry. I'm talking to you from New York City, and I know that around here so many people work on Wall Street, and, you know, certainly we're making broad generalizations here, but I wonder if that might be part of it.
That makes a lot of sense to me. And so those are the pros. The cons certainly are you have to watch your kids' spending, and I mean, if a child spends in a bad way, what do you do? Do you cover for them? Do you report them to the credit card company, or how do you resolve those issues?
Yeah, it brings up a good point that sometimes the kids aren't even trying to be sneaky. I mean, I talked to one mother whose child accidentally spent $300 on an app and just didn't realize that it was actually real money changing hands, that all these things that he was buying in the game,
right,
it wasn't virtual currency, it was real currency. So in that case, she was able to explain her situation and get a one-time break from the company. I think it really just relates to parenting in general. We need to watch what our kids are doing online. We need to watch what they're doing with their friends. And same thing with their money. It's not one size fits all, but it's important to teach your kids about this.
Ted Rossman is an analyst at creditcards.com. You can read the report there. Ted, great talking with you today. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.